Thank you. So since I'm also new and I'm only here for this week, I want to introduce myself. I'm Axel Görlitz, and I would like to work with cold molecules. But as an experimentalist, I have first to find a way how to produce them. And that's essentially what I'm gonna talk about here. And first of all, I want to thank the organizers of this workshop for having me here as an experimentalist who can learn a lot from theorists and get a lot of stimulus for his experimental work. So we are working with ytterbium rubidium, and we believe it's a candidate for an ultra-cold paramagnetic molecule. And this is sort of the outline of my talk. I have enough transparencies to fill 1.5 hours, but I hope there's a lot of discussion that will skip some transparencies. So I will give you a brief introduction to our system. I will then, in the first real part, talk about not molecules, but ytterbium-rubidium mixtures and interactions that we've observed in a conservative trap. Before I go to excited state molecules, ytterbium and rubidium star, where we did some photo association spectroscopy. And then in the end, and that's where I hope to get a lot of input, is we are currently trying to find a way to get really the molecules that we want. So the ytterbium-rubidium system we chose quite a while ago. And as a mixture, we had something here where we had completely unexplored interactions. Nobody had worked on that before. And to date, I think nobody's working with this system, at least not to the extent we do. We could independently manipulate the two. We could possibly, and then I'll talk a little bit more about that, find Feshbach resonances, either magnetically or optically. And with ytterbium, we have a lot of room to play with. We have 5 stable bosonic and 2 stable fermionic isotopes.
Are those stuff reasonably abundant that you can get them easily?
They are sort of. I mean, let's say 4 stable bosonic and both fermionic isotopes are easy to get. The 7th isotope has an abundance of 0.3% or something. So you could get it, but it's a little bit harder experimentally. The other 6 are really, even as an experimentalist, we can do almost as the theorists do. We just replace one by the other within 10 minutes. In the calculation, you can do it easily. Usually in the lab, it's a little bit more difficult, but here with ytterbium, it's really simple. As a molecule, the special thing about it is that it's got a doublet sigma ground state. So we will have a real paramagnetic molecule once we get to the ground state, because it has an electric and a magnetic dipole, and that will sort of be a toolbox for spin lattice models. I will not go into detail here, that's still something for the theorists. We are not there yet experimentally, but that's one of the motivations that we have for going for a molecule where we have electric and magnetic dipole moment. The properties of the ytterbium-rubidium mixture, if you have 87 rubidium, and that's what we started out with. I mean, for us initially, rubidium was only rubidium 87 and either of the ytterbium isotopes. If you look at the simplest properties, the scattering properties, what we've drawn quite a while ago is a picture like that, where this looks like a Feshbach resonance. You tune here the reduced mass, and you will get a scattering length which varies, and it might have a pole. Unfortunately, we can only go in discrete steps here, because we can go from one isotope to the other. If we add the fermions, we would get a couple more points. And this is just an artist's view, and I will later on show you that this is not really only an artist's view, but that with our experiments we can really show what it should look like. So there's a wide range of interaction properties expected. That's mostly for the mixture, and maybe also for the way how to produce molecules. Ytterbium-rubidium molecules, as when we started out, there were none. And then a group at our university has started to at least do theoretical ab initio calculations, which should give us sort of a hint what it looks like. It's a damn hard molecule, I guess, to calculate. I mean, that's what theorists tell me. I have not tried myself, because ytterbium has so many F electrons. But you can do it sort of reasonable calculations ab initio, and they came up with a potential depth of the ground state of around 850 inverse centimeters, and electric dipole moment in the ground state of around 1 dBi. So this is not the most dipolar molecule that you could wish, but it's not bad. It's at least much better than for example, than atoms who have only magnetic dipole interaction. So we do all our experiments in a machine that here is sketched here, where we have a lot of lasers to cool the atoms. I will not go into detail here. That's all technical. It looks like this, or it looked like that, I have to say. Nowadays, you cannot really see the machine anymore because there are so many mirrors and everything for all the experiments we did around the machine. But it's just...
How big it is? Just
The diameter is approximately 30 centimeters. And this is a typical clover leaf trap inside here for working with the rubidium. So the first experiments we did before we could do anything is to look at the interactions in our system. And what we are interested in is really going into conservative traps. We need a mod for cooling, but all the experiments that we want to do, what you really want to do in a conservative trap. And we thought about a nice way to build a conservative trap, and that's a hybrid trap, which essentially is a magnetic trap for rubidium and an optical trap for ytterbium. And in order to make the optical trap such that it's not seen by the rubidium, we chose a bichromatic optical trap where we cancel the light shift for rubidium, because one of the two light fields is blue detuned and one is red detuned with rubidium. So to lowest order, we can cancel the light shift on the rubidium and then have magnetic trap for rubidium and an optical trap for ytterbium. And that's what the potentials look like for ytterbium and rubidium. I have to say this is only lowest order, and essentially it's only one point in space, namely where we overlap the two Gaussian beams. In reality, the trap looks quite a bit more difficult, and this is the potential for rubidium in particular, due to the different divergences of the two laser beams. You get in three dimensions a potential which has not only one minimum but several minima, and it turned out, and I'll go to that later, that makes it a little bit hard to work with. We can do experiment with this hybrid trap, and it's a nice idea, but it's not as simple as we initially wished. And here you see a cross section. You see there are several minima and for the rubidium, and it's hard to determine that the rubidium is really in the right minimum. If you want to look at interactions, namely the minimum where you also find the ytterbium.
So why can't you just use an optical trap? Why do you need a magnetic trap?
Our idea was to have independent manipulation independent manipulation. That's what we started out with, and it works pretty well. I mean, we can exploit the independent manipulation to a certain extent. Only if you get very cold, then these bumps in the potential play a significant role, and that's our problem.
Don't you get an advantage in terms of overlap also, that you can cause them to maximally overlap by adjusting the two? Was that your concept with independent?
That was our concept. I mean, sort of, you can compensate for gravitational sag by just moving the optical trap a little. But it turns out that that's not that simple, because the optical potential for the rubidium is not just the potential that you would get from a single beam. Because the two light fields, if you add them up, give you a three-dimensional potential where you have several local minima where rubidium atoms might hide. And so it works to some extent, but it turs out you have to be much more careful than you.
Why is this so?
All this just because we start.
Because the dipole, if I think it's just a dipole potential, it has to follow the geometry of the.
Yeah, but that's the point. The dipole potential just follows the geometry of the light fields, and if we have Gaussian beams and focus the 1064 and the 532 to the same size, they have different divergences. That means away from the focus, you will have a much more difficult potential. Because the blue detuned 532 light is repulsive for the rubidium, while the red detuned light is attractive for the rubidium, and that gives you an overall potential which is just much more complicated, and it provides these sort of local minima which have caused trouble. But we could work with it. I mean, it's not that you cannot work with it, but it's just not as simple as the initial plane idea that I've shown here. So what we did in this prep is we first looked at the collisional property. I mean, that's what you start out. So we looked in the regime of a couple of microkelvin. We prepare ytterbium in this bichromatic optical trap. We prepare rubidium in a magnetic trap, and then independent manipulation means we can just move the magnetic trap for rubidium onto the ytterbium and maximize the overlap in that situation. That works pretty well for these conditions, and we have a well-defined spatial overlap. You will see what well-defined means. So what we then did, I said we can switch between the isotopes of ytterbium very quickly. We just looked at thermalization for different isotopes, and these are thermalization curves that are well behaved. That's what you expect for 172, 173, and 176 ytterbium. You have thermalization of the ytterbium to the rubidium temperature. The increase in the rubidium temperature has nothing to do with the thermalization. This is just due to some heating, the remaining heating in the experiment. So that works pretty well. You have different thermalization times, meaning different scattering cross sections, but that's all within a range that's normal, so to say. We could do a quantitative analysis, and there we have the problem that for a quantitative analysis, we really need the overlap integral between ytterbium and rubidium, and since the rubidium sits in a relative crumpled potential, it's really hard to get a very good handle on that. We can just assume, I mean, so this is sort of a sketch of what the rubidium density looks like under the conditions we've chosen here. So we have rubidium outside here, a little bit inside here. Here is the ytterbium. So the overlap integral is hard to control. We can only sort of look at relative behavior of the different isotopes. And that already gives us a clue of what's going on here. I will not quote scattering length here because we've long since given up to try to get scattering length because of this overlap integral that's hard to control. We did the same experiments with other isotopes, and the other isotopes here are 170 and 174. With 170 ytterbium, we nearly saw no thermalization at all, meaning there is a scattering cross-section which is pretty small. If we increase the confinement, then we increase the density of the rubidium, and finally we saw just a little bit of thermalization. So just remind you, the red is the temperature of the rubidium, black is the temperature of the ytterbium with rubidium present, and blue is just some reference curve of the ytterbium temperature if there's no rubidium present. We saw a little bit of thermalization, and so we see the cross section is not zero, but it's much smaller than the others. And since here we have a little bit better control on the rubidium density and the overlap density, we dare to at least give an estimate of, let's say, around 10 A naught of the scattering length from these measurements.
Excellent.
Yeah.
How are you measuring temperature? How are you defining it?
This is a good thing. Temperature is sort of defined as what we get out of a Gaussian fit at a given point here. Since it's not fully thermalized, this is not a perfect measure, but since we couldn't really get out we couldn't get hard numbers out, we think it's still a valuable measure. It's sort of an average energy per atom.
Yeah, okay. But also for the crumpled trap, you did the same thing?
We measured the temperature after release of the atoms from the trap. So we looked at the kinetic energy after turning off the trap.
Action.
Yeah.
170 and 74 are bosons, and 73 is a fermion.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So almost all the terbiums here.
And 73 is fermium. But for these experiments, it didn't. For the interspecies collisions, this shouldn't have an effect. But we also worked at some point with 171. But this is what we can work with. So this is right. Temperature is not very well defined, but it's close to being defined for what we are doing here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I missed something. The ytterbium is in the trap with the 164 laser, right? The ytterbium, it is in the optical trap.
Yeah, the ytterbium and the rubidium are in a trap with the 164 laser and a 532 laser. If we increase the power in the 164 laser, then we suck the rubidium more or less to the same place where the ytterbium is, and then we can control the overlap integral quite a bit better. But that's not the point where we actually have rubidium in the magnetic trap. We just overcompensate the repulsive 532 potential for the rubidium with the 1064, so that essentially we have an optical trap also for the rubidium. The magnetic field doesn't play a role anymore. Yes.
So yeah, you have different slopes, eh? So for the rubidium temperature and also for the ytterbium temperature.
Yes, I mean.
And of course, you have different conditions of density. But also, you have different scattering. So the scattering between rubidium and ytterbium, and tells you something about the thermalization. But then the thermalization within rubidium and ytterbium is given by their own scattering. Right? And for instance, if one is very different than this interspecies scattering, then the thermalization can, for instance, not happen. Also within the
yes.
So do you see those effects here, and can you maybe deduce the value of the scattering of ytterbium?
No, we didn't try, because there's very, very nice work of the Japanese group, I guess, in collaboration with Paul, to deduce all the scattering intraspecies scattering length of ytterbium, and the slope here of the rubidium. This is essentially heating. I mean, the rubidium is thermalized with itself and is essentially heating, and then we add hotter ytterbium, and it's cooled down a little bit.
Another short question. Does the permeability of ytterbium well known have been measured in the trap by the Japanese group, for instance, or the kind of thing, or it is known for atomic spectroscopy?
It's known from spectroscopy. I mean, it's about in the 1064, it's a factor of 4 to 5 the polarizability of the rubidium's the trap depth is larger than for ytterbium alone. I mean, it's we know it from spectroscopy, and here we.
No, just wondering, just because you know, for erbium or dysprosium, there is a controversy on the value of the permeability, which is measured in the dipole trap, compared to what is obtained with spectroscopy by a factor of about 2, and so I was wondering if somebody ever checked that for ytterbium.
I think Mariana Safranova has done some
I could give you some references.
Yeah. Well, but actually, the point is that my point was, if you try to measure the permeability within the dipole trap just by shaking it, by shaking it to a certain extent, to see if you find indeed those either spectroscopic or theoretical value or something different, which is the case for erbium or dysprosium.
I mean, to the extent that we know the power. The trap frequencies that we, of course, measure agree with the spectroscopic data.
Well, I mean, in the ytterbium clock, in fact, the permeabilities have been measured very accurately.
Yeah.
I mean, this, I don't know how many of these four or five significant figures, at least differential ones. Yeah.
I mean, this is more in the experimental details. It's very hard to know the real intensity at the atoms. And within that knowledge, this is all fine. Okay, so we have 174 ytterbium, and there just the opposite behavior. If you put the 174 ytterbium together with the rubidium, I mean, under the experimental conditions we had, we were not even able to see thermalization, because the first time we could look at, which was after 20 milliseconds under these experimental conditions, it was already cold. So we just couldn't observe the thermalization. It was just an extremely large elastic scattering cross section for this particular isotope that we observed. So we dubbed these two isotopes extraordinary. The other ones are just normal thermalization. The one doesn't thermalize, and this one thermalizes pretty fast. And then we did some experiments. Actually, we wanted to put the two together, and it didn't work. and I'll tell you why it didn't work. We went to larger ytterbium density, which means, again, as I've shown you before, we increase the power in the 1064 beam, which sucks the rubidium into the optical trap, thus increasing the density of the rubidium to 10 to the 14, up to 10 to the 14 per cubic centimeter. And then we just expected we could get nice sympathetic cooling working, or we were just looking what happens. And the first thing that happens is that we have fast loss of ytterbium due to probably three-body collisions, which is to be expected if you have a large scattering length, that you've got three-body collisions involving rubidium and ytterbium, and you have fast loss of ytterbium. So that's one thing that you expect. The other thing we didn't expect at all was that if we increase the density of the rubidium, and here you have a picture of rubidium and one of ytterbium in the trap, then here you start seeing a hole coming up in the ytterbium cloud. And if we increase the density even further, then essentially the ytterbium is expelled from the trap center. Just, we didn't change anything about the trap geometry here. The only thing we changed is putting more and more rubidium into our system, and it looked like some sort of phase separation. But this is, we have to say, this is not in the degenerate regime. This is in the thermal. This is in the thermal regime, and there it's really hard to find a way to get something like repulsion of mean field being the reason for this.
Actually, have you looked at W. Garrett or the Land's work? He looked at these sort of mean field thermal effects, if you wish, and you can get phase separation and significant.
I'm not yet aware of that, but we came up with we tried to find out something. We are far in the thermal. We are at three microkelvin, and if you think about it and you try to find out just by mean field effects how large the scattering lengths would be, you end up at a value you don't find a value that could explain that. Because the zero temperature scattering length just doesn't have a meaning anymore at three microkelvin, if you have so large effects.
Which is this the bosonic?
This is bosonic.
What's the Bose condensation temperature?
The Bose condensation temperature under these conditions would be a couple hundred nanokelvin.
Oh boy, never mind.
We are way above that.
Okay.
And I don't want to go into all the details. I just want to say we observed that separation, large range of temperatures, and also rubidium was above the Bose condensation temperature, and we didn't see any effects on the rubidium, and this is just due to the fact that we had. That we had much more rubidium atoms than ytterbium atoms. So sort of the ytterbium atoms broke the rubidium, but the reverse effect was not observed. So there's unusually strong interactions. We had already seen that in thermalization, but we also see that here. And then Paul and IT came up with a diffusion model, which essentially says, just to make the long story short, the large cross-section of interspecies cross-section slows the motion of the ytterbium into the rubidium. The large three-body coefficient leads to a loss of ytterbium due to collisions primarily in the trap center. And then you end up with a mode where the ytterbium sits outside and the rubidium sits inside. And essentially, the lifetime of this mode is much longer than what you would naively expect from the three-body loss coefficient, because due to the large scattering cross-section, the rubidium sample almost becomes opaque for the ytterbium. So the ytterbium just doesn't really enter. And if you calculate that, then you have a slow spatially dependent ytterbium loss and you get this hole in the ytterbium distribution. It lasted for 400 milliseconds, so it's quite a while. And these are the calculations that were done by IT and Paul. And they show you that here, the lifetime that you get is much prolonged if you have this large cross section, and that you get a lifetime that's much longer than what would be expected from the nominal three body loss coefficient. So if you assume that that we have unitarity limited cross section here, and a rubidium density of 3 × 10⁴, then we end up, then a scattering length of around 500 A0 is sufficient to explain that behavior that we've seen here. Our very dumb mean field model, which was not correct, ended up with a scattering length of 10,000 A0. Which is not reasonable here. Okay, then we...
Wait a minute. What do you mean not reasonable?
The thing is, at 3 microkelvin, if you have a zero temperature scattering length of 10,000 A0, then at 3 microkelvin, the cross section you see cannot just be calculated by 4 pi A squared. Because you have a temperature dependent cross section. So what we did is we assumed first a cross section of 4 pi a square and then end up with 10,000 A0. And then you realize if it was 10,000 A0, it wouldn't be allowed to assume the temperature independent cross section at 3 microkelvin anyway, and this sort of is if you do it this way, you're missing the point. I mean, you can have 10,000 A0 zero temperature scattering length, but you will not have a cross section of 4 pi a square at 3 microkelvin. That's the problem that you have here. So just a simple mean field, a very simple experimentalist-minded mean field model is not sufficient to explain that. This diffusion model, on the other hand, grasps the behavior of the system. So then we went on to really try to do molecules, and doing molecules, we went back from the conservative trap to a magneto-optical trap. And what we first had to know, we had to learn something about the molecular structure of ytterbium rubidium. Nothing was known about that, and what we started out to do is learning something about the excited state structure, doing one photon photo association. And the experimental scheme is pretty simple. We continuously load two mods, a green mod for ytterbium with around 10 to the 6 atoms, and a rubidium dark spot mod with around 10 to the 9 atoms. And then we shine in an additional laser, which shall be resonant with a transition from free atoms to a bound molecular excited state.
Close to the
rubidium D1 line.
It's already quite
a
very high.
It's the first excited state. So we picked the first excited state. Essentially, main reason is we had the laser for that. This is. It might be better to go to another line, but we had the laser for that, and then. If we scan this laser and we see rubidium loss, then this means we have rubidium 2 formation. This has been done a long time ago. And if we scan the laser and we have ytterbium loss, then it's the formation of ytterbium rubidium star molecules. Essentially, in that case, there will be again no effect on the rubidium. We have 10 to the 9 rubidium atoms, 10 to the 6 ytterbium atoms. If we take away one rubidium atom to produce a molecule, ytterbium rubidium star, We just don't see it in the atom number. So what we did is we scanned the laser close to the resonance and looked for the desired features. And this is what we got. If we scan down to the tuning up to 8 inverse centimeters from the D1 line, we got several features where we saw a loss of ytterbium atoms, and those features can be looked at in more detail. And essentially, close to the atomic resonance, all the structure of the rubidium atom is preserved. And first, we see the hyperfine splitting of the rubidium in the excited state, and then in addition, we see a rotational splitting in the excited state. We are at a pretty high temperature, so we are not in the S wave. The temperature is a couple hundred microkelvin, and so we see several rotational lines here, and we can go even further. If we look at the rotational lines, we even see a splitting of the rotational lines, which grows as we go further into the potential well, and this is essentially a coupling of the total rubidium angular momentum to the nuclear rotation. We haven't investigated that much further. What we then did as experimentalists, before we asked theorists, just to check whether at least the binding energies we measured are sensible, we did a Lira-Bernstein fit and put all our data together. Essentially, this is just assuming a C6 potential in the excited state, and assuming this simple-minded C6 potential, we came up with a C6 coefficient, which is not the C6 coefficient of the potential. It's just you make the assumption you just have a C6 potential, and then use the Lira-Bernstein formula. You see it fits pretty well, and then you end up with the C6 coefficient of the excited state. This just tells us that that we can identify all the lines pretty correctly. In order to go more precise, to really determine the C6 coefficient, you have to look much closer at it, and the potential is certainly not just a C6 potential. After knowing the excited state, which unfortunately only lives for 10 nanoseconds, and this is nothing we want to work with, we went on to look at the structure of the ground state, which is what will be really important for experiments with ultra cold, or for going towards ultra cold molecules. And in order to do that, we used again the photoassociation laser that we've used before, but now we put the photoassociation laser on a one photon photoassociation resonance. So we have a permanent loss of atoms from the magneto-optical trap, just due to the photoassociation laser, and then we shine in a second laser and look for a reduction of the loss. And the reduction of the loss you get mostly due to light shift effects. But what we were interested in is not the real, it's not the specific process that happens, but we just know that if the probe laser causes something here, then from the difference in frequency of the photoassociation laser and the probe laser, we can infer the binding energy of the very weakly bound vibrational levels of the excited state. We have to account for hyperfine structure, but that's simple, that's known. And the probe laser in our case only couples transitions with delta R equals zero, because we have very long range molecules. So the experimental scheme is the same as before. We shine in a PA laser, we have continuous trap loss, we shine in the probe laser, and now we look for a reduction of the trap loss. If the probe laser is resonant with a molecular transition from a vibrational level of the ground state to the vibrational level of the excited state that we address with the photoassociation laser. And we used two different single photon photo association resonances that you had seen before, essentially just to double check. What we now get is something like this. So one is the number of ytterbium atoms if you don't shine in a photo association laser, and 0.5 is the number of about 50% of the atoms remain if we shine in the photo association laser, and then if we shine in the probe laser, we get these peaks which can all be identified, where we have a reduction of the loss. And what we have here is the frequency difference or the wave number difference between the photo association laser and the probe laser, and from that we can immediately read off the binding energy of the weakly bound vibrational levels. We have corrected that here for the hyperfine structure. Oh, here it's not yet corrected. Since we have hyperfine structure, we also get some resonances here where the probe laser has less energy than the photo association laser, just because we then couple to the other potential with the other hyperfine ground state of rubidium. And this here gives you what we later on identified, the vibrational quantum number of the state we address here, counted from the maximum state. And again, we first, and this is only again brief, did a Lever-Bernstein fit to make sure that what we identify is correct. I mean, this is what a Lever-Bernstein fit definitely tells you. And assuming a long-range potential, we end up with a C6, which is not the C6, it's just of the wrong potential, the coefficient that we call C6 here. But still, for us, that's what we can do. For us, this means we have identified the resonances correctly. We did all this work that I've shown you so far with 176 ytterbium and 87 rubidium in order to go a little bit further and have a handle on more exact handle on the potential. We did the same for other isotopic combinations, namely also 87 rubidium, but now also 170, 172, 174 ytterbium, and you see a nice mass scaling here, which tells you the molecular potential is essentially the same. What changes is the reduced mass in the system, and we could detect the binding energy here with an accuracy of around 10 megahertz, and then essentially we do a mass scaling here just from the fit parameters that we got from the Lever-Bernstein fit, and it fits perfectly well. And then Paul Julien came to help together with Matthias Bulkowski, Piotr Zuchowski, and Roman Giorillo, and did a better evaluation of our data by trying to fit the whole thing with a potential. It's combining an ab initio potential with a long range C6 plus C8 potential, and then trying to fit our data. With this much better potential than just the long-range part that we had done before, and this is work which is in preparation. Then what you get out is by fitting this, you get several, or you produce several potentials with different numbers of bound states, so you get a discrete set of potentials which fits our binding energies. And if you look at the best fit here, you get a C6 coefficient, or a C6 of 2,813 atomic units, which is very close to what Safronova has calculated for this system. And this here should be C8, of course. This is not the C6.
What is the error bar?
The error bar on this is, I guess, It's on the order of 13 atomic units. But one thing is it's probably a little bit larger, because what best fit means that you do a Mateusz and Piotr have done a chi-square fit on our binding energies, and we have two potentials, namely the blue one and the lower one, which approximately give you the similar chi-square. And the difference in C6 that comes out is larger than the error bar, than the fitting error bar on this potential here.
So the error bar then comes from what, statistics, or is it,
From the fitting, it says 2,813 plus minus 13, and the next is 2,829, I guess, for the C6 coefficient for the next potential here. It's a little bit larger. So the error bar is on the order of a couple of 10 atomic units.
We're getting obviously similar numbers, because you would. Yeah. The thing that really puzzles me is that our fits have been driving, as yours obviously have, to a C8 to C6 ratio that's well over 100. And that's 100 square four, if you like. And that's quite hard to justify, actually. It's hard to see how C8 over C6, you've got 150
yeah.
here.
Yeah, yeah.
But we get 150 to 200 as well.
Yeah.
But it's hard, that's really been giving me pause, because I've been thinking, that looks unphysical, that ratio.
I could completely believe that. For me as an experimentalist, I have just the data that we measured, which are correct within the error bars we state. That's our point of view. So maybe the potential just doesn't really grasp everything here.
The initial potential is varied continuously with the parameter, right? This is in the model, I'm not sure that.
It's an ab initio potential where I don't understand all the fine details of calculating that.
You have the ab initio potential, and then there is a factor. That was
the. There is the ab initio potential.
This is the factor.
Then there's a scaling parameter for the ab initio potential, and then there's a switchover function to go from the short range ab initio potential to the long range, which essentially comes from our data.
Why don't you propagate the error to look at the ratio of C6 to C8 and see what the actual error is on the ratio? That'd be sort of interesting to find out, don't you think?
Yeah, the statistics aren't that good. I mean, the number of data, you can get statistical values of these within any model potential, but the model dependence is more of a problem than the statistics.
I see.
If you change the model a bit, you'll get a different number.
I guess
every time you'll get a variation of that ratio, which is small compared to how much it changes between one model and the next.
Would you correct this with an extra term, like a C10? I don't know about.
Well, yeah, in principle, there should be a C10 and a C11.
Part of the problem is that we don't really have good potential forms. It's interesting that in the second week of the conference, Edward Artiman gave us an enormously long talk about getting potentials and long-range forms and so forth. It's remarkably subtle and difficult to get these potential forms at work. For one thing, dispersion begins to... it's damped, it's cut off, it's not, yeah. The C6 and C8 in effect are not...
But Paul, that entire series actually, if you continue, it diverges.
Yes, yeah.
C10, right. C10.
Yeah.
And so basically, doing this stuff is probably more of an art form than a science. there are all kinds of issues that lurk in the...
And I'd say that nothing is known about how dispersion is damped in systems as heavy and with such fluffy electron clouds as this. All the work on damping has been on tiny things by comparison with ytterbium.
But here, this model works just because you have information about several isotopes, right?
Yes.
This is the main constraint, which means otherwise you could have... the reason why you can indeed have the potential depth, right?
Otherwise, yes.
It would not be possible.
Yes. this helps us. So that's why we measured the several isotopes.
And I don't know about your fits. In our fits, there's a best depth, but it's not totally unambiguous.
Right.
No, in our case, it's all. I mean, here this fit produces. I mean, as I said, two potential curves essentially. With two depths of 760 and 788 or something.
They put the key bound states in the same place, which yes. is the thing that matters. But
exactly.
Yeah, the number of bound states is effectively determined by the isotope shift and doing the different isotopes. But yet, whether you can pin it down, you get the right number of bound states to within one is a question, I think, whether the data is quite, the potential model is quite good enough to let that happen. So there's definitely uncertainties.
There's definitely uncertainties, but I have to say, in terms of what I'm going to talk next, what we want to do, the uncertainty is not that bad. I mean, if you, I know that there is uncertainty, but it's not that bad in order if you want to know how to go on.
So if you would ignore the switching function and just would see where somehow the slopes connect together, I mean, does it look really bad?
Yes,
because that gives you an indication of how bad your emission potential is. Right?
Yeah, I think I haven't actually done any of these fitting. It was actually all done by Matthias Borkowski, yes. who's Roman Cirillo's graduate student in Torun. He's actually sat down and done the fitting and all that stuff. So
we've done the same thing independently. So I guess I can answer that. No, it doesn't look too bad. The C6 and C8 that. Our electronic structure calculation at least goes reasonably close to the C6 and C8 with a different, to the C6. Our C8 to C6 ratio from the Appuccio is not anywhere near 150. and they never are.
just comes out of the
you need it to fit the data. Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, but then if you take that potential, or whatever we get out here, we can look at, does it reproduce the scattering lengths, or the scattering behavior, let's say, that I've shown you before? And yes, indeed, it does. So now we just take the measured binding, essentially the measured binding energies, fit it as good as we know it, and then we have now not an artist's curve of scattering lengths versus the relative mass, but really something that's modeled onto experimental data. And you see, for 170, we get a pretty small scattering length on the order of 10 a naught, while for 174 we get a scattering length close to 1,000 a naught. So that reproduces semi-quantitatively, I would say, our thermalization data.
Although your 173 was one of your normal ones, right?
173 was one of our normal ones. However, the scattering length is negative here, so I would assume that also for the negative scattering length at low temperature, there must be a minimum somewhere. So there is a minimum in the cross section at a few microkelvin, like in rubidium 85, and that could give you a thermalization which is much slower, because also then at our temperatures we cannot assume the temperature independent scattering cross section.
This comes out of Townsend window.
Yes.
I suppose that was further away from the pole than that, but all right.
Yeah, so that's what's reproduced by the data here. I mean, the main things are 174 and 170. You're right. When I saw the value for 173, the first guess was, we didn't really quite see essentially this identical behavior. There could be a slight difference in experimental conditions with 173, that we had a little bit different temperature because fermions cool differently than bosons do because of hyperfine structure, but I think it's still reasonable. Okay. Okay, so yeah, we don't want to go too much into detail here, but knowing now the scattering behavior of the ground state, we can also use this two-photon spectroscopy to learn more about molecular transitions and the strength of molecular transitions. And for that, we did essentially use the same two lasers and did out-of-town spectroscopy. And now we did it just the other way around. Instead of putting the photo association laser to a fixed frequency, we put the laser which connects the two molecular vibrational levels to a fixed frequency and couple the two levels. And if we increase the intensity here, this will give rise to a splitting here, to an outer town splitting, and that can be then probed by the photo association laser. So we turn on a coupling in the molecule and then probe it with a photo association laser, and from the splitting we can directly infer the strength of the molecular transition, essentially the Frank-Compton factor. And as I said, the probe laser couples the bound-bound transition, the PA laser is scanned over the one photon resonance, and we can determine the Rabi frequency from the splitting, and from that we get the Frank-Compton factor. And this is what it looks like. This is a one photon photo association spectrum without a coupling laser. And if you look at all the levels we have here, there is quite a few levels which are relevant for coupling. We can couple R equals 0 to R equals 0, or R equals 1 to the different components in the excited state. And then we did this in the experiment. We put our coupling laser here to the R equals 1 plus 1 component as we dubbed it, do the scanning of the photo association laser, and we see a nice splitting here. And from this splitting, we can then infer the Rabi frequency. We put the coupling laser to the other transition, to what we dub here R equals 1, MR or whatever you call it, minus 1, and we also get a nice splitting of this line here. And then we put it to the center, and what we see is then you split actually the R equals 0 and the R equals 1 component, just because the thing is, what happens here is we picked a line that's very strong. So where the outer turning point is approximately the same for the ground state and the excited state, and the excited state potential. That means you have the same rotational constant, and then you have a coincidence of the two frequencies here, R equals 0 to R prime equals 0, and R equals 1 to R prime equals 1, just coincide because you have the same rotational constant. And then if you put the laser here, it's essentially putting the coupling laser here and here at the same time, and you see splitting of both lines. So this just tells us we've understood what we are doing here, and this just happens because we pick a very strong line, and the very strong line is of course the one where you have a large Frank-Compton factor that you have if you have overlap of the turning points.
So when you interpret this, you basically hold the level positions fixed at what you found from the two photon photo association, and all you're trying to pull out of the outer towns is the Rabi frequency.
Yes, right? This is yes. You can do it to some extent. In this here, you can do it as long as the splitting here is smaller than the splitting of within this R component. This is all we did. I mean, this is experimentalist minded, but it tells us that we are all we started out with much larger coupling, and then this whole thing gets so messy that we didn't understand it anymore. Now this is actually relatively weak coupling for this line. And this is again what I've shown you here. These are the two couplings we address at once, and then we scan over the different excited state components. So this of course, what we wanted to do is find out something about the coupling strength. And here it's relatively simple, because what we have to do is we really have to just measure the splitting, and this is just measuring a frequency difference. This is a number that can be determined experimentally pretty well. And here we've increased the intensity of this coupling laser up to 40 milliwatts. And we see the splitting increase here, and we see a nice linear dependence of the splitting on the square root of the power as expected. And from that we can determine Frank-Contan factors. There, what comes into play is we don't know precisely the intensity the atoms see, so there's a relatively large error. But if you take the numbers we get, we find that for the two different excited states we use here, either the minus 11 or minus 9 level, we get different couplings to the ground state, where we maximize our Frank-Contan factor. And what we get out here is a little bit less than 0.5. The absolute value is hard to determine. What's important is the relative value compared to the other lines. Here that we have, these two are essentially the same. There's just one going from the F equals 1, one from the F equals 2 state. And this should give the same Frank-Contan factor, since the ground state potentials should be practically the same. Okay, so this is now what we have done. Now this is what we want to do. Now we have to go back to the conservative trap if we want to exploit what we've learned so far to do ground state, to make ground state molecules. And one way would be to go back to our hybrid trap, but as you can guess from what I've said initially, we saw some problems with the hybrid trap, the imperfect overlap, and the really hard experimental control and reproducibility of the system. Made us think about, can we just use a simple optical trap? This is experimentally simpler. We have practically automatic overlap of the two atomic clouds as long as the trap is sufficiently strong and we can neglect gravitational zag. If the trap gets weak, then for the two different species, they will be at a different position due to gravitation. And we have a 5 times deeper trap for rubidium, and we have no independent manipulation, but we still think this is the best way to go now. It also means that our initial approach of using our workhorse rubidium to cool the ytterbium doesn't work here. What we have to do here is we cool the rubidium using the ytterbium, but it turns out that this is fine. For what we don't want to do now, this is fine. And our first try is the simple optical trap. And we want to find a route to create vibrationally excited molecules at the first place. Of course, we want to go to the ground state later on, but first vibrationally excited molecules. And the obvious idea that comes up in our field is to look for Feshbach resonances. And at first glance, I thought, and told that for several years, there are no Feshbach resonances. Because the ytterbium has a singlet at zero state, and why should there be any coupling? And then came a paper, or at least in the end two papers by the group of Jeremy, which showed there can still be some sort of coupling in such a system, which is not completely negligible. And this makes us hope that we at least can identify Feshbach resonances in the system. Whether we can use them to make molecules will be the next step. And they made calculations for strontium rubidium and ytterbium lithium, and they came up with some widths which are in the strontium rubidium system, which are reasonable. I mean, one could expect that with these widths you could actually manipulate the system to make molecules. Ytterbium rubidium doesn't look as nice as I've been told, but at least the coupling is also not non-negligible for some cases. So knowing, yeah?
What would be the advantage of using these magnetic Feshbach resonances instead of optical ones that operate close to the intercombination line?
I mean, if you want to make ground state molecules, the optical Feshbach resonances will produce excited state molecules. Essentially, I mean, they will put the ytterbium atom in the excited state, and we want to make ground state molecules. I mean, they could be useful if you want to manipulate the interspecies collisions, but for going to molecules, yeah.
Excellent. One possibility is that the one color takes you up, and if you know the Frankonian factors, there will possibly be some Frankonian factors that are very highly efficient to single lower levels, but, as is known in strontium 2, for example. But you know, you got to get a little lucky on that. So, and you always lose some efficiency. You always throw away some molecules that way.
Well, that's what I've just shown. I mean, that's why I showed this on the Town spectroscopy. We get pretty large Frankonian factors for certain transitions. Already here where we
these were at the D1 line.
This were at the D1 line, yes.
I think the point really is that
what I already
showed for at the intercombination and for strontium, that you have levels that if you photosort it into those, they decay almost 100% into the electronic grounds and not into, they don't redissociate the atoms. So for strontium, I would say that this is.
But here,
then we saw something similar for strontium ytterbium, right? Not.
But I don't think this is. I mean, I think the intercombination line would have some advantages, but I don't think that is a feature of the intercombination line. I mean, essentially, also in our case, the coupling from loose atoms to the excited molecule is much weaker than the coupling from the excited molecule to the ground state molecule. So also in our case, we will, most of the excited state molecules will fall into molecules and not into free atoms. I don't think this is really a feature of the intercombination line. The intercombination line has other advantages why we would want to go for the intercombination line. And the one thing is in our case, we will have rubidium loss due to rubidium resonances, which are abundant. And at the intercombination line, it should be much easier to pick out a region where you don't have.
No, so I mean, intercombination line, everything is much slower, so you could think of having a stimulated emission to the ground.
Yes. This is true. But if you just want to look for a decay, the line here should also work to some extent. Okay, so just to wrap up the story about the Feshbach resonances. From our knowledge of the binding energies, we could ourselves actually calculate more or less the positions of Feshbach resonances. We don't even need too much of a modeling because we have measured the binding energies in the region where we would expect Feshbach resonances. So we have just to do a little bit of fitting essentially any function that fits our binding energies to get there. And This is how you do it. We have the open channel in our case in 87 rubidium is here the channel which corresponds to rubidium in the F equals 1 state, the closed channel in the F equals 2 state, and then we looked at the positions of the possible Feshbach resonances. This is rough guess values derived from a simplified model, but that's already good enough to within a couple of percent. And the lowest resonances are in a range that's for us experimentalists not that easy to access. In particular, if you have a machine that's not built for doing Feshbach resonances. Because when we started out with that, we didn't really think about Feshbach resonances in this system as we believed there would never be one. So, 168 ytterbium is the only one that we could reach without changing our power supplies, and 168 ytterbium is the one that you've never seen on my transparencies because the abundance is only 0.3. Yes? We thought about, yes, there's another rubidium isotope which has some problems by itself to work with, but it's a very nice isotope. And for this other isotope, we find much lower Feshbach resonance. Feshbach resonance is as much lower field. As Jeremy tells me, this is nice in terms of you can get the magnetic field. This is bad in terms of the widths, which will be very, 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 very narrow. Nevertheless, we've set out to see if we can see something here, because that's what we can do. What we can do experimentally. the main reason that they are at lower fields is the smaller hyperfine splitting, essentially. that's the reason why you find some resonances at relatively low fields. So what we did is we put 174 ytterbium and 85 rubidium in a single beam optical trap, and what I show you here is a Feshbach resonance for rubidium 85, which we found thanks to our colleagues in Durham, which have sent us the data of the Feshbach resonances. I guess it's already accepted. The paper they've just put out before publication or even before submission, and we just looked at the same place, found the resonances, knew that they were right, which we believed anyway. But it helped us to just show that we can, to just prove ourselves, we can work with Feshbach resonances. And this is a particular Feshbach resonance, which also has a pretty narrow theoretical width. The lossy width is much larger than these 1.8 milligauss in our case, but also in the Durham, case. And this is our search for 85 rubidium 174 ytterbium. And I intentionally show you these data because this is really raw data. And if you really want to see a Feshbach resonance, then you pick this one here. And this coincides sort of with the position that you would get not from the potential, from the best potential, but from the second best potential. But looking at this more closely, even these data points are not anything that we can believe. So we have no evidence so far. The thing, what happened here is you see one data point close to where you suspect there could be something, and then you take more data, and if you plot them all together, then of course you find more data outliers in this region. So this is a zero result, what I show you here. If you really wished for, you would pick one, but it's nothing. So far we have seen nothing. We should probably also go not to 174, but at least to some isotope where we for a couple hundred gauss and not in the 100 gauss range.
Do you hold the field stationary in order to do these measurements, or can you modulate the field a little to broaden it? Or?
We've tried several things. We've modulated the field, we've done it stationary, we've tried several things.
What's the temperature of these scans?
The temperature of these scans is on the order of 10 microkelvin, but that's the same for the rubidium. We've also done scans at various temperatures. I mean, this is on the order of 10 microkelvin that we did here. And in terms of the loss for the rubidium, this was a very convenient temperature for the rubidium to look at. There the loss was almost 100% for the rubidium too. And here we could look at rubidium, and we also could look at ytterbium, but we didn't see anything reasonable so far. So what we will do now is, this was done in the single beam optical trap, we will go for a cross beam in order to increase the density. If you want to look for free body loss, then you should go for high density. And that's what my guys are currently working at. I mean, I hope they already have it together. Just if there is something to see a stronger feature.
10 microkelvin is getting up into a sort of, you've got quite a few P waves there.
Right? Yeah. So the alternative route, that's what Paul said. We could excite to a single vibrational state by one photon PA, either close to the de Vaughan line or close to the intercombination line, and then make use of large Frank Contan factors to populate only few vibrational levels, not to say to populate mostly one vibrational level of the ground state. And maybe that's even a better route, because that could go much more quickly than going for Feshbach resonances. We will not yet give up on the Feshbach resonances, but this is definitely a route we will pursue in the near future. And the final step, and this is just the last thing I want to say, we are not yet there, but once we are in the ground state, and we will try to do stir up, and I don't see a reason why it shouldn't work in this system. If we pick the right frequencies. The only problem is nearly nothing is known about the excited state here. It's not like the bi-alkalis where you have pretty good data on the spectroscopic data. Here we don't have really good spectroscopic data, and that might be harder, because believing ab initio calculations of the excited state.
You should be prepared to tune your lasers by 20-word numbers or 30-word numbers.
Yes, that we can do.
Well, because even if you don't know anything about the excited states, if you are prepared to tune to scan your laser over some big amount of wave numbers, then you will find a couple of lines. You will have some chance to find them. Once you have one, then you can guess from an initial calculation, you can guess where is the next one and so on.
Exactly.
And so, but the point is that you have to be prepared to do this job of whatever molecular spectroscopic is.
That's essentially what we want to do. We have to make our system so stable that we can do that over nights. Yes, that's an advantage. And we are. That's an advantage. Okay, so at the end, this is the team that's been working on it. These are two PhD students and a master student. I have a new master student who began on the experiment. And thanks again. And I've drawn up a lot of time, but I had quite a few questions.
Well, great. If anyone needs to leave to go to the conference, please feel free to do so. But as that starts, they start up at 2. Otherwise, I guess we're ready. The rest of us should hang around for asking a few more questions.
I'd like to go back to this experimental thing that I was telling about the plausibility.
Yeah.
The point is that the plausibility is well known, and that's fine. And then you interpret all your things in terms of this well depth of the trap, which is known, fine.
Yeah.
My point is, have you tried, or could you try, to measure that plausibility by, once again, looking at the frequency of the trap, by checking them, and looking at the response of the turbine, and see what value you would obtain from this. And again, it is because this is the kind of method that they use for erbium and dysprosium, and we are led to a value which is really different from what is estimated from spectroscopy. And so it's really a puzzling situation. And so just wondering if somebody else do the same kind of experiment with, ytterbium is not like erbium or dysprosium. And this is the point. It's only a singlet as atom and so on. And so it's not clear yet what is the reason for this discrepancy. And just to see if there is any kind of, stupid reason why we would discover by that way, so, or you would just observe the same value.
So, Olivier, what's the direct spectroscopic measurement of
the fact? The idea is, when the spectrum of erbium or dysprosium, the atomic spectrum is quite well known. And so the point is,
you mean getting it out of some rules?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you take the sum rule.
Oscillator strengths and some rules. Okay.
Then the point is that you obtain from that a value of the plausibility, which is larger than what is observed in such a cold atom experiment, which means that even with the strongest transitions, you already have a plausibility which is larger than the one which is observed, which is kind of puzzling, right?
So then, what's the one that Andre, who's just left, mentioned having come from the clock?
That's ytterbium.
That's ytterbium.
But that's
not that 4 significant digits.
Okay.
So yeah, but again, it is known. The point is, what value would you get from such a measurement, but with a different atom, to see if there is anything related to the profound nature of those atoms, like dysprosium and erbium, or the cloud.
Experimentally, there are some issues that you raise when you do that. The thing is that we don't really have a harmonic potential. So yeah, that makes already a big error, as we know. If we start shaking the trap, it really depends on the temperature, what we get out, and then it's obviously not alone something that we get out of the trap. As I said, for everything we've done, we haven't really checked it to an extent, but we have looked at it. Is it consistent? If we know the beam weights, if we know the intensities, and measure the trap frequencies, is it consistent? And it's consistent, probably to within 10-20% of what we assume, but we haven't done a really very good check on that. And I don't know too much about dysprosium and erbium work, whether the experimentalists would really like to be nailed down on their numbers.
The experimentalists, the strontium is what, it's a triplet H. It's a very, it's an open shell with a massively open F shell with extremely different properties from terbium, which has a closed F shell. So in many ways, dysprosium may be, it's so complex as an atom, much more complex.
Yeah, but again, I mean, we know some from the spectroscopy, so you know from the same rule, you know the probability from the spectroscopy, which is, I believe, the value which is well established in some sense. And the point is that now you try to measure it from this.
Well, that's where I actually, I haven't seen that work on the sum rules, but it's so complex, I'd be really skeptical anyone could actually do a sum rule in a meaningful way on this process.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they've done it, but I wouldn't believe it.
Why?
Because, well, look, you got all these F electrons. I mean, you got to sum up not to 2, like, or but you got to sum up to something like 14 or 16. And get every bit of that over the whole spectrum, which includes the continuum, and I just don't think they have that data. So the sum rule stuff
probably some data. There is quite a lot of data actually on terbium and dysprosium that we have done.
There's a lot of data, and they can do a sum rule. I'm just saying that I haven't seen it. I hadn't looked at that, but I think I'd be really surprised if they can do it. So the fact is there's a discrepancy with the measured polarizability, which they see by shaping the traps. You know, they see how it responds to light. That doesn't agree with some rules. I'm not surprised for dysprosium. For terbium, I'd be really surprised if there were a big difference.
So I'd like to discuss.
And that's why it'd be nice, you know, some guys like this would actually. But it's known, you know. Mariana Safranova and Andrei's left, but they both calculated fully ab initio the atomic structure for ytterbium. It's in perfect agreement with the experimental values for ytterbium, where we have nearly 3 significant digits in the experiment. The perfect agreement.
Well, this is why I'm asking questions. So, but I would be interested to know more about, you know, this some rule would not work and so on. I'd like to discuss with you about it.
Sure, let's do that. Any more questions for Axelon? Well, I guess we can take our break now, or go ahead.
So in the beginning, you mentioned that molecule can have magnetic dipole moments and being polar. Can you just say a few words? I mean, what is the implication of this? And, you know, you talk about the future of the gases.
I mean, essentially, you have an additional handle on your atoms, an additional degree of freedom, which might make it possible. And there's been this nice work of Peter Soller on that to use it for spin lattice models. If you put it in optical lattice, this is sort of the idea behind it. I haven't gone into too much detail in the thoughts about that. But the idea is we have an additional degree of freedom. Also, if you think about quantum control, it might be better to have a second handle. Not only the electric dipole moment, which in the end is not the same as a magnetic dipole moment, because you need the external field to make it show up, and the magnetic dipole moment is just there. That's for anything like quantum computation, the magnetic dipole moment will be what you want to use.
Just one comment on what Jun Yi was able to do with OH, which also has a magnetic dipole moment and an electric dipole moment. He could, you can decelerate with the, in this particular case, with the electric dipole moment and trap it magnetically. So you know, you got two different handles on its cooling, trapping, manipulation aspects before you even get to the condensed matter stuff.
Yes.
I mean, I think the point is that the different kinds of molecules really offer different many-body outcomes, and that's quite different from atoms. And I think that, you know, as many-body theorists, so we can understand out of these molecules, whether it's a singlet sigma or double sigma or double pi, you know, they have different sets of internal degrees of freedom that can be controlled in different ways, and that way we can set up, you know, one interaction or another we want, whether it's exchange or whatever, to get some sort of interesting many-body phase. So just to answer, I think, what everybody's interested in. Yeah.
Another way to say it is in terms of anisotropy, because then you could have a dipole electric dipole there, magnetic dipole there, and then you would have different kind of anisotropy in different direction and so on.
Yeah.
So that could be the.
My only response to that is that you kind of, for singlet sigma, you sort of already get that with hyperfine, you know, that the nuclear hyperfine structure can have a different sort of direction associated with it compared to the electric field. So, I mean, it's not a dipole, but just to say that, it, you know, there's,
there's already that anisotropy in the single sigma. The simple single sigma chaos in molecules. Again, that's something different about molecules compared to, you know, just magnetic dipoles like chromium or whatever. Yeah.
Well, just one point for Jeremy, I think, Jeremy, because you looked at this stuff, but the alkaline earth, they're all chemically reactive, right?
Yeah. Because there's a pretty weak binding between between two alkaline earths, it's always going to be exo-energetic to form the homonuclear alkali dimer and check out.
Do you know whether those are Berio's reactions?
No, I don't, but I think they would be.
They probably would be,
What did you say?
Barrierless. Barrierless, in other words. They'll go at zero energy.
No, sure.
Okay. I think we should probably stop. Anyone can absolutely.